New from U.S. author Mike Palachek, Camp America. Here's what American poet David Ray has to say. Mike Palachek reminds me of Socrates, the gadfly who asked unwelcome questions, Diogenes with his lantern looking in vain for an honest man, Chekhov, the man with a hammer challenging the complacent family to share their meal, Kerouac, the ever on the move, somewhat hysterical searcher, and he also reminds me of many Americans who as children were so blasted with propaganda that they're devoting the rest of their lives to challenging the lies and all who tell them. In this land where babies are brought by storks and buildings collapse due to unpatriotic bricks, we need the gadfly, because no leader, preacher, guru, or saint will wake us up, though the doomsday clock is ticking close to 12. David Ray, American poet, author of The Endless Search and The Death of Sardanapalus and other poems of the Iraq Wars. To order Camp America and all of Mike Palachek's books, go to the New American Dream website, www.newamericandream.info. Howard Zinn writes, Mike Palachek writes with passion, wit, and always with a strong social conscience. Camp America, from author Mike Palachek. The website again, newamericandream.info.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
Time for another edition of the New American Dream radio show, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory, that's me, and Mike Palachek, an American writer. I'm proud to be associated with Mike as publisher of several of his books and now as co-host of this show. We want to share our dream for America. We'll let you know what's wrong with the dream that's touted by the powers that be, the dream centered on power and acquisition that seems more prevalent than what we believe. We'll tell you about our dream, too, our vision of a world where people help each other instead of crushing their neighbors so they can get ahead. We're fortunate to have progressive radio legend Peter B. Collins appear on our show tonight. He's in the unusual position of being both a sponsor and a guest. I want to assure you that won't make my questions to him any less uncomfortable than usual, nor would he be appearing tonight if we weren't interested in what he has to say, donation or not. Nobody pays to get on our show. I'll let Mike tell you about our poet of the week, as well as his version of the New American Dream.
Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, it's I got to talk about the weather again always. It's 40 degrees in Duluth, and that's very wimpy weather. It's not, I guess we're not going to get down to our below zero like I kind of have gotten used to. I did one good, one weather-related note. I got caught in the fog today, the famous or infamous Duluth fog. I was driving along, and I actually got lost for about a half hour, but here I am. Our poet tonight is Ken Greenlee, and he comes from Denver. I met him when I was on a book tour, three years ago, I think it was. I'm not sure. It was a while back. And I'm very excited to be able to talk to him again. And we'll do that in the first part of the show. And again, I get a chance to talk about the New American Dream. And that's kind of what my thing here in the first part. The kind of people we have running our government, if we really knew the truth, I believe we would be astonished. We really have to forget about George Washington and the cherry tree, Ronald Reagan making America strong again. That's bogus. the George Bush is riding into the baseball game on national TV to throw out the first ball, then sitting in the front row. Forget about Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, the new liberal Democrats who care about you. You know, I'll tell you, SpongeBob and The Simpsons and South Park have more to tell us than those guys. If you really want to be a true American, you need to know what the CIA has done in other countries, supposedly in our names, and make sure to read your William Blum every day. You need to know what happened to Gary Webb after he wrote a story about CIA drug running in Los Angeles, a story that ran in the San Jose Mercury News. It was back in the early 90s, I believe, when the web was first getting going. And I remember reading that when we first got America Online. And if you're anybody, I can't remember that. Remember that famous dial-on tone they had? I can't do it. But I really thought, here we go. This is going to be a big deal. But then that was it. Now the main media is worse than an underground junior high newsletter. There is reason to wonder if we really went to the moon and that the government has been withholding information about UFOs. There is the possibility, of course, that some of these so-called conspiracy theories are only that. But the whole idea about this new American dream thing is that it can never be argued that we should not ask the questions. At least in the Soviet Union, when they saw nonsense and lies printed in Pravda and TASS, at least they knew they were lies, you know. We are still at the infancy stage in our development of not questioning the lies. And by the way, Bigfoot is real. I guarantee it. Bigfoot is real, and each one of the millions of high school history books in the bottom of millions of hall lockers are make-believe. That is really where we are. That is really who we are. And so the next time there is a bombing or a threat of a bombing or a bunch of blue backpacks found in Bemidji, the healthy American, the true American, the real American thinks CIA, FBI, the police. The real patriot refuses to stand for the national anthem, and rather than another knee-jerk reciting of the Pledge of Allegiance, he says, not until I get some questions answered, because this is important stuff. The anthrax letters, remember those? Wow. What a time. I actually had a paper out back then. I was 19. No, I was 45. It was a job, the Sioux City Journal. I got up before light every morning, sorted the papers, and read about the 9/11 bombings, the Patriot Act, the anthrax letters, and then watched TV. All the lies and the rush to invade and kill someone, just kill anyone. Let's read the anthrax letters. The first one. It has a date at the top, of course, it's 9/11/01, although it wasn't sent out, I think, for a couple weeks later. Capital letters, all caps, this is next. Take penicillin now, of course, penicillin misspelled. Death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. The next one, sent a little bit later, again, 9/11/01. You cannot stop us, we have this anthrax. You die now, are you afraid? Death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. These were written and sent not by folks in a cave with a pen made from musk oxen tail, but by U.S. government agents with advanced degrees from American universities, paid for by our tax dollars that we earned by getting up at 7 a.m. every morning to deliver newspapers. Seriously, that is our world. Sorry, but I'm just saying, they want us to be afraid. Look at the part in the anthrax letter. Are you afraid? We cannot be afraid.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C. until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 Truth Group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Now it's time for our news and letters segment. Last week, we asked listeners to tell us what they thought about WikiLeaks, specifically whether they thought it was real or a government sham, a disinformation scheme, perhaps even a honeypot. Listener Ed Kendrick said, "The litmus test for trustworthiness that I use is whether the official lies of 9/11 are supported." He goes on, "Julian Assange said last July, 'I'm constantly annoyed that people are distracted by false conspiracies such as 9/11, when all around we provide evidence of real conspiracies for war or mass financial fraud.'" And he says, "Assange is an actor in a control drama, not the real thing." We'd like to hear more from you, our listeners, on this or on the spreading unrest in the Middle East or on anything you think is important. If you want to be anonymous, that's okay, too. Just tell us so when you send your question or comment to radio@newamericandream.info. You want to kick off the news briefs, Mike?
Sure, Chuck. Monday, February 21st at 7 p.m., at Brave New Books in Austin, Texas, author Jim Mars will be speaking. It's 1904 Guadalupe Street. And you notice my pronunciation of Guadalupe? It's not Guadalupe, it's Guadalupe. I learned that when I was down there with her. Anyway, the genie has granted your wish. Jim Mars, the greatest living conspiracy author and researcher, is in the hot seat. It's a free-for-all where Jim will try to answer any question that is bouncing around your head. Ever wonder who actually killed JFK, who financed Hitler's rise? What banks make up the private Federal Reserve? Where are the underground alien bases located? Come to Brave New Books at 7 p.m. on February 21st on Monday and find out.
And on Wednesday, February 23, actually it's from the 23rd to the 27th, the International UFO Congress in Scottsdale, Arizona. They have a website, ufocongress.com. The International UFO Congress was established in 1991. They host an annual conference on UFOs and related phenomena. It used to be held in Laughlin, Nevada, but now it's moving near Phoenix, Arizona. The conference boasts more than 20 speakers and a plethora of exhibitors from around the globe. It covers a large variety of topics related to the UFO phenomenon, including technology, government cover-ups, exopolitics, black projects, crop circles, alien visitation, and more. Panels of astrophysicists, nuclear physicists, abductees, former top-secret clearance military personnel make up just a portion of highly decorated and influential speakers. The 20th Annual International UFO Congress, hosted by Open Minds Productions, be at Fort McDowell Resort and Casino in Scottsdale, Arizona, an event you don't want to miss.
And after you go to the UFO Congress, you're going to want to go to the Lebowski Fest in Tampa, Florida, February 25th to 28th. If you want more info, go to dudes@lebowskifest.com, lebowskifest.com. Lebowski Fest in Tampa, Florida, February 25th to the 28th. It's a natural, zesty enterprise.
And now, profiles in heart to those who have given or are still giving their heart and soul, helping us all have a better world. Our thanks for caring. If any of these names are not familiar, they're really worth a Google search. Again, our thanks: Dan Berrigan,
Leonard Peltier,
William Rodriguez,
Bob McElveen,
Marilyn Buck,
Elizabeth McAllister,
Fred Hampton,
John Lennon,
and the Kent State students Allison Krauss, William Schroeder, Jeffrey Miller, and Sandra Schuer.
I'd like to now bring in our poet of the night, Ken Greenlee from Denver. As I said, I met Ken in Denver a couple years ago at a reading at a restaurant or a cafe that I cannot remember the name of, but I'll try to remember to ask him. The number of places he's lived is only exceeded by the number of jobs he's had. Greenlee likes to explore the themes of class division in a supposedly classless country, the struggle to stay spiritual in the modern world, and first-time experiences of any kind. He thinks art, particularly writing, should combat media brainwashing and examine the clash between what we're told and what really happens, especially in times like these. His work can be seen on outlawpoetry.com. He also is a poet or a contributor to the Cost of Freedom, and he contributes to the East Coast Lit Mag Big Hammer. Ken, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing, Mike?
All right. You've been in Denver for a while now, huh?
Yeah, I have. 18 years. It'll be 18 years this March.
I guess that's a while. I thought you moved or something. Maybe you moved in within the town or something. I don't know.
I move around town a lot. Well, okay. The neighborhood we were living in was getting gentrified, so we had to move around a lot.
Oh, okay.
Places kept getting sold, you know.
Yeah. Where did we read that one time? With Michael Annis.
Oh, that's at the Mercury Cafe.
Mercury, that's kind of a famous place, isn't it?
An epicenter of poetry in Denver.
Really?
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
There's others. But,
yeah.
It's
for sure now because you and I were there, I would imagine. Probably as really.
Yeah, I had a good time that afternoon, for sure.
They're very accepting to a good venue for a lot of events
and a lot of political events as well.
Okay.
How's Duluth treating you, Mike?
Not too bad. The weather's getting better, but the winter wasn't that bad. You know, everybody was saying how it'd be, oh, have you been here for a winter yet? But Ruth and I kind of figured that Iowa was just as bad as up here, or at least the last couple of years, and it wasn't too bad. There was just a little bit. What are you working on now, Ken?
Well, I'm working on a bunch of poems. I'm probably closing in on 100 poems or something. So I figured I ought to put a book together. Thankfully, I've been getting asked to read around town more. So, you know, I like to keep ahead of that curve and have new stuff for people to hear. So,
you sent me a book. It was just a few years ago.
Can you speak a little louder, Mike?
Huh?
Could you speak a little louder?
I don't know if I can. How about that?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. You sent me a book about 3 years ago, or maybe it was five, I don't know, but it was a while back. What was the name of that book? It was...
Oh, that was Temporary Guaranteed Shelter. I'm glad you asked about that. Oh, go ahead.
No, go. You go.
I'm glad you asked about that. Those are three stories that... one was about working at a junkyard, and one was about being a temporary, and one was about having to go to a shelter due to a ice storm. So, but they formed the foundation for this new book that I have called Distance. It's a collection of stories that are all connected by a distance run. They all take place in the head of a working class distance runner during the course of one run. He's worked a lot of warehouses and factories and odd jobs, too. So there's plenty of on-the-job action. Plus, there's memories of his teammates and things that meant something in the long-distance world. And also, there's a lot of first-time events. So I like to write about first-time experiences or surprises that you get, whether good or bad, you know.
Very cool. Do you want to get into
I'm going a traditional route with that now. I'm pitching that to agents and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But, it's going to get out there one way or another. I have some good printers, so I could always self-publish it if I wanted to.
Yeah, you got to have that Kinko's.
I got these people in Florida, Maverick.
Watch out for that.
Yeah, give them a plug. They're really good printers. And they hold their binding holds forever, and I haven't talked to them in years. They'd be amused at my survival as a writer, you know. They'd be like, you. I had
I
a really weird cover, so
they
remember me, you know.
Hey, can you tell me just a little bit about yourself, your history, and how you came to be a writer? Can you put that into?
Yeah. How I became a writer by accident, or I always kind of like to write, but I was going to take this art course, this drawing course, and it was full. So then I took I said, all right, I'll go for creative writing. I had this guy, Mark Crawford, who's pretty famous, who was famous, you know, on Life magazine for a while, and then he was teaching at Rutgers University. We're in the classroom, we're waiting and waiting. I'm like, where's the teacher? This was in the good old days when they had pubs on campus. They're like, oh, he's in the pub. He reports in a half hour later, and he's like, hi, I'm your teacher, Mark Crawford. I'm also God's gift to America. And that's how it started. And no, he was for real, though. He's like, hey, I may look shabby, but I have a magazine happening. You can be published. He points right at me, you know. He points at all the people in the classroom. I don't want you all to be serious around here. And he knew a lot about the basic elements of fiction, you know, like how you use dialogue and stream of consciousness and regular narrative to get through the information and the scenery, paint the scenery and advance the action and so forth. You know, he had like 15 components. He'd kill me now because I'm forgetting them, but basically he was a great teacher and very serious too.
Where are you from originally? What geographically? Where are you from?
I was born in New York, and I went to school until second grade there, which I'm really thankful for. It was very for real, and provided some material that I still use to this day.
And you mean the city? You were raised in the city?
Say again?
You were in the city, New York City?
Yeah, well, I was in the New York school system until like second grade. Then my dad got a job in New Jersey, and so we moved down there. And at the time, New Jersey was a pretty nice place. I mean, yeah, I guess people from New Jersey might be listening, so I got to be careful how I talk. But
I'm sure they think it's a pretty nice place.
It was very much more woody than today. We were the first developments there, you know. And there was a lot of woods and farms in those days. And the northwest corner of that state is still pretty undeveloped and woodsy. And, of course, there's the shore. A lot of my friends from New Jersey, we lived in a town in central Jersey at the time. They ended up at the shore, so that's always a good place to be.
Yeah. And then you went to Denver.
And as far as how I got the experience I got, I guess I just started working early. I was going to school and living home, and things weren't going that great at the house. So I moved out, and I've been working and writing ever since. And the first place I worked was a Revlon cosmetics factory, and it was just a huge place with huge machinery that was just... made your jaw drop, actually. And it was graveyard shift, too, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that provided a lot of material as well.
Yeah, I bet it would. It gives you... It was a factory, and it was just... you could think then, just when your hands get used to what they should do, your mind can do other things, right?
Yeah, in fact, yeah, good point, Mike. That's just how it was going. My mind would drift on the stories I was writing at the time, and I would... Excuse me, I was still going to school at the for writing at the time, so yeah, a lot of the projects I was working on I'd have going in my head. Except when they had you mix giant vats of shampoo or conditioner for suburban women's hair, you know, because these were huge tanks, I mean, the size of a house that you would fill with water, and then all these, you'd dump a pail of this ingredient or a shovel full of that ingredient in there, and then turn it on, and it would go like a whirlpool, and steam would pour off of it, and you'd be walking around a catwalk around it, so you had to be careful there.
You got to be careful, or you'll end up in a shampoo bottle in Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Yeah, I doubt it would even be noticed either.
Hey, I want to know, is social justice a major part, or... of your writing, or is it just a part, or how does that work?
To be honest, it's a part, or it's a major part, but I also write about things that happen every day, and or you know, just just the fantastic in the everyday, you know, the look of a person headed to work on the bus, the mystery corner where everything gets lost in my backyard, you know, nature. I write about nature a lot. I'm out in the desert, you know, I'm next door to Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona, so I'm out in the desert, and I've been writing about that more. But, no, I would say about, you know, half my stuff's either I call it political, you know. It's, I guess you would say it's about social justice. I feel it in my heart, and that's why I'm not that happy with the, you know, the way events are going. And I had more hopes for this man in Washington, Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, I
think we all did.
I knew he wasn't the panacea that everyone said, but yeah, this is, it's too bad. But yeah, social justice forms a major basis of my writing. But I take time to write about other stuff that touches me and touches my soul as well.
That look of the eye, or the you know, the subtle personal detail, that sounds a lot like Guy Clark. He's just awesome that way too. Would you feel like reading a few of your poems for us?
Sure, I would.
Okay.
Here's one called "The Bees Don't Want That Monsanto Food." Now the bees are disappearing all over the world. There are those who say that the reason is they don't like those genetically modified crops brought to us by Monsanto. So now these industrious creatures that we rely on for cross-pollination are leaving, turning their nose up at that Monsanto food, buzzing away from our bad diner. Crummy cuisine, lousy service too. The humans don't respect the customers no more. So the bees are blowing this tomato stand, turning their nose up at that Monsanto food, gathering up into a crazy cartoon-like angry black bee cloud and droning away into the blue crack of twilight. Never again to spread the pollen. Never again to share the nectar. Never again to spread the pollen. Never again to share the nectar. Here's one called "Gasaholic." Gasoline-addicted Americans roar down the highway again in their SUVs, Hummers, and supersized pickup trucks with names like Sierra, Ponderosa, Ridgeline, and Sequoia. All natural names for very unnatural vehicles that drink a lot. Gasaholic Americans lean heavily on brittle fossil fuel crutches. Hordes of them buzz like angry bees toward an asphalt-cracked horizon. Gas pedals stomped by millions of feet attached to brains that somehow never make the connection between oversized vehicles, rampant fuel consumption, and the irresistible urge of their petrodollar government to invade smaller, weaker, oil-producing countries. No, sir. It's just drive, drive, drive. There's a shining star out there on the horizon for each of us. The constant promise of more, more, more. So off we go, reaching, grabbing, clutching, clinging, devouring anything in our path like termites. Very little human about us now. Cell phone, earplug, gadget things, mostly. Just a mouth connected to an asshole. Nothing in between. Ramjet engines of consumption. Product is sucked in one end. Waste spews out the other. Who cares? Now here's one about every man. I was watching A Prisoner lately. And The Prisoner, the old series. And it said Every Man Productions. And it got me writing this. Every man today. Every man is a powerful force, unstoppable, in fact, if he knows he's every man. The problem today is every man watches too much TV, listens to too much right-wing talk radio, gets all his information solely from corporate-owned American sources. So every man today is brainwashed, thinks he has nothing in common with everyday people. Every man today sees himself as an enterprising entrepreneur, sympathizes with and emulates billionaires, celebrities, and politicians. Every man today honestly believes they're going to let him in on their exclusive, lavish party.
Every man today thinks he's going to be one of them, thinks he already is one of them. Every man today doesn't know he's every man anymore. Thus, the loss of power and everything else. Really big steps. I can't fly in my dreams, but I can take really big steps. I mean, huge, like a whole football field. Long, soaring strides carry me when I sleep. I can't fly in my dreams, but I can take really big steps. I scissor kick over high razor wire fences and glide above houses. I grab the top of branches of trees and swing sideways around them like a horizontal pole vaulter. Propelling myself high into the sky, I drift along, taking in bird's eye views of fields, forests, and faraway mountains, of houses, roads, and shopping centers, a floating view of the fleeting grids of man. I can't fly in my dreams, but I can take really big steps. I mean, huge. The only problem is, I have to come back down. All right, that'll do it.
Thank you very much. Those are really cool. Every time I hear a poet read, and I told you before, to our Ken, you know, you sent an email. I said that you asked me if it was okay to say swear words, and you know, we've had three poets on so far, and every one of them have emailed me and said, "Can I swear?" And I said, "Sure, go ahead." But you know, the poets must just be a angry subculture out there. You know, I don't know.
Angry. We're recorders of daily language, so I think that's one of the cool things about American language. You know, the American language is that there is curses in its everyday use. I mean,
yeah.
I think they've lost their incisiveness. They're just like a retread of a curse, if you will. You know.
And that's
part
also
of the language. That's funny. I just figured on the air, you know. I don't want the FCC to come down on you, Mike.
I don't know. I don't see them anywhere around here. I don't think they have FCC in the
loop. I was goofing around. What do they look like anyway?
I don't know. I think they have FCC jackets with them on the back.
And they probably look pretty square, huh?
I don't know.
Except the undercover ones, man. They have like Serpico-like FCC people, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, you mentioned some appearances and readings. Is there anything you want to tell us about that you got coming up?
Well, every Wednesday now, there's a cocktail hour reading, every second and fourth Wednesday over at Ziggy's, right, on 38th, which is a main drag at Denver. I'm just thrilled that there's a cocktail hour reading because, you know, it's just a very relaxed atmosphere, and we're all friends there, and it's from 6 to 8. So that's been my main headquarters for now. And I read with a local variety show from time to time called Stage C. Yeah, they're really the nicest people, and what they have basically is a guest band, a house band, a storyteller, a poet, me, or people like me, and then back out the other way. So that takes place at the Mercury or also at the Cameron Cafe, too. So,
very good. Very
good. Yeah, I've been doing that. And basically just going to that biweekly reading. And there's a writer's group I have dinner with with like eight of us, and it rotates house to house. And we meet every month. We just met up last night, so. That's what I've been doing.
That's pretty cool. You get to
if you want to catch me read in Denver, go to Ziggy's the second and fourth Wednesdays, 6 o'clock. Cocktail hour reading.
Okay. Tell me again about the book. The next is that gonna, you know, you said you had the big amount of poems and you're gonna try and put them together. Is that, should people be looking for that, or is that kind of a...
No, what people should be looking for is that collection of stories I was talking about,
okay,
called Distance. That all takes place in the head of a distance runner.
Okay.
And it's a full-length book, And that'll be coming out one way or another in the spring. So keep that name in mind, Distance.
Do you want to give it?
Yeah, I like the title because it's not just about distance in terms of ground covered. It's the distance we gain with age, you know, as we look back, and a spiritual distance we gain too, as we cover ground on this world.
You've got an amazing insight. You really do. You've got a gift, and it's cool that you keep at it and keep working at it, and we all profit from that.
Well, thanks, Ken. I've had the management in the sky has been giving me the time to spend more on it. So, you know, I've had a part-time job for a while, so that's been paying. You know, keeps the lights on, but I can still write. So, yeah.
Cool. That's cool. You need that light.
Well, yeah. It's hard to write in the dark.
It is. Okay. Hey, Ken. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mike. And it's great to hear your voice again. And thank you for having me on the show.
Would you do it again sometime, I hope? Will you come back again, I hope, sometime?
Oh, sure. I'd love to.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay. You too, Mike. Take care.
Yep. See you later.
Bye.
And just a quick note here about see something, say something. You know, what more inspiring words have ever been written? See something, say something. Just feel those words on your tongue. Think of Tom Paine, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Mark Twain. We at the New American Dream want to do our part in protecting the homeland. We realize the folks frisking chunky people coming into hockey games and NASCAR races and those brave men and women on the front lines of the airport scanner Maginot Line need our support. So we are initiating Program Neighborhood Watch. We know that the FBI and CIA and local police are usually the ones bringing drugs into the USA from Central America. And we know that the FBI and CIA killed John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. So we know that it is the FBI and CIA and local police who we have to look out for. So if you see these government license plates in your neighborhood, please call someone. If you see something, say something. Call a Walmart department manager, or maybe that one guy who checks IDs at the Eagles Club on Fridays. Here are just a few license plates to watch out for, more as they come into us. G12-3472A. WEBRNDWCO. WIIDIDOKC. WIIDID9/11. And in the spirit of the whole fair and balanced ethic of the United States media, we also wish to tell everyone about the New American Dream Red Phone, sponsored in part by Nike. As much as we like to talk, we love to listen, especially to those brave men and women in uniform serving to protect us from big bees overseas in over 545 countries around the world, as well as those who protect us on the homeland front from big bees from Mexico. So we have open lines, and it's really only open to the free and the brave, the armies of one, and those being all that they can be. If you are one of those, we want to hear from you. Here's that number. 814-459-4599. And thank you for all you do. This phone's for you.
Well, now it's time for our special guest, Peter B. Collins. Peter Collins started in radio in Chicago in the 1970s, first covering the Watergate scandal when he was 19. He had a highly rated nightly talk show at ABC-owned WLS in Chicago, then went to KGO in California, various stops between then and now. And now he offers a podcast at httppeterbcollins.com. In addition, he co-hosts The Boiling Frogs with Sybil Edmonds. That's at http://www.boilingfrogspost.com. Peter, you and I are contemporaries by age, but you've been at this radio stuff a whole lot longer. You're probably tired of telling people how you started, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I believe it was in the Watergate years in Chicago?
That is correct. I got my start back in the 1970s in Chicago. And one day, I was doing this all-night talk show, guys, and I got called into the front office, and they said, "What the hell are you doing?" And I kind of acted dumb, and they said, "Your ratings have gone through the roof." And I said, "Well, that's Nixon's fault." But, yeah, we covered Watergate on a daily basis. It was quite a crisis of government, and some of the same factors are still in play here over the 30-plus years later.
Well, they certainly are. Anyone in radio for all this time must really love it. What's the special attraction for you?
Well, I'm a person who is burdened with too many opinions, and my life partner, Kathy, likes it for me to have an outlet, a radio show, a podcast, and sometimes I do more than one at the same time. And the other part is that I just love the form of communication. I've worked in television, too, and I just vastly prefer radio and audio podcasts now. Because you can, one person can control it. It's not driven by pictures or market research of what 25-year-old females want to see. And you can just have much more of an impact at a much lower cost and control it. So I own my own presses now. I do a podcast, and nobody can tell me how long to go or when to stop or who to talk to, what to talk about. And I don't have any of those pressures. I also work at a commercial radio station in San Francisco doing talk shows, mostly on the weekends. And so I kind of keep a foot in the mainstream media while I maintain my own outlet here on the wild frontiers of the Internet.
Well, that's great. And I'm glad you mentioned the big mainstream media, because, some of us think that big media is pretty much state-controlled or business-controlled. Those are about the same thing. Run by the establishment. At least that's what we used to call it when I was growing up. But now you're saying that you're part of that media, at least part of the time. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, sure. I believe in being an inside agitator when they will let me. And so what I do is try to bring over to the corporate media some of the stories and the views and voices that are missing. And, I think Rachel Maddow provides a bridge of that sort. I think that Keith Olbermann was doing that. And, Tom Hartman is a guy I have a lot of respect for who works in commercial radio, but brings a perspective, a worldview that is much more in touch with grassroots independent media. And so, if I were to compare myself, it would be in that respect to Hartman, where, I want to be able to express myself and to cover the stories I think are interesting, and at the same time, I want to reach the largest audience that I can to infect with the virus of my point of view.
Well, that's very well put. Indeed, the mainstream is the only way that you're going to reach a big audience all at once, I think. But hopefully shows like this and like your podcast can get some listeners and build up a kind of a grassroots thing.
Well, let me just offer you a little perspective there, because from 2005 until early 2009, I had a 5-day-a-week, 3-hour-per-day syndicated talk show. And this was when Air America was underway and trying to change the commercial radio landscape. And so at my own expense, and I owned the program, that way I wasn't working for Air America or Clear Channel or any particular other media company. And I was able to build up to about 13 stations, Phoenix, San Francisco, Monterey, Portland, Seattle, a few other, Sacramento, a few other cities. And still, I wasn't able to make money with it. I couldn't build a big enough audience as an independent to really cross the threshold to make it work. And so it was with great reluctance that I pulled the plug on that and moved to podcasting in June of 2009. And after a year of podcasting, I've reached a level where we're comparing apples and oranges to some extent because the measurements are different. But in a broad way, I have more listeners now who are more dispersed. They're not just living within 30 miles of a transmitter, but I have more listeners online than I did at the peak when I was on more than a dozen AM radio stations. So there's a real future in internet media, and it's one of the reasons when, Mike, you contacted me that I was very supportive and agreed to become your sponsor for a couple of shows. Because I've been impressed by a book that is called Be the Media. And I think that we all have a responsibility to do what we can to reshape the media. And nobody's going to hire me to take over NBC or Fox or any of those networks, but I can control what I do. And there are millions of Americans with a little ingenuity and a few bucks who can buy a microphone, get a computer, build a website, and begin podcasting. And I think that this is the solution to corporate control and right-wing dominance of the media in this country today. We need to build our own networks, and we really see an example of this, and I don't want to overplay the Facebook and Twitter aspects of the revolution in Egypt, but it clearly is a factor because, you know, we don't have complete state control of the media the way Mubarak did in Egypt. But he couldn't keep Al Jazeera out. And Al Jazeera isn't the only Arabic news network. There's Al Arabiya, and there's several others that you don't hear much about here in the United States. But my point is that, you know, people were ingenious and resourceful, and they communicated with the means available to them that went around the state control. And that's something that we need to model here in the United States, where individuals and groups who have information, who know how to investigate, who have opinions or political agendas, we need to organize and we need to get our information out, because we can make a difference as individuals. And we can take on the big machine.
Well, that is an extremely encouraging to hear that your experience has been positive. And I'm certainly aware of the part that you know, crowdsourced media, for lack of a better term, has played in the events in Egypt. And actually, things seem to be cascading into some other countries over there. I also want to thank you for your support of our show, and I think it's great that you try to help out startup shows like ours, and it's I think the whole communications industry will be changing or continuing to change in a very big way, and it's exciting to be a part of it.
My dad was a truck driver, and he taught me that when there was somebody with a flat tire who was broken down at the side of the road, that you pulled over and helped them. And I saw him do this many, many times, and they'd always be very grateful and say, well, can I give you $10, or can I buy you a six-pack of beer? And he would always say, nope, just help somebody else down the road. And there are a lot of people who opened doors for me, who said yes to me, who you know, had enough faith in the things that I brought to the table to give me jobs at radio stations, let me talk on national networks. And I'm just very aware that it's my job to open doors for other people as well.
Helping people is what it's all about. And we appreciate your help. And I know that I always try to help people change those tires or push their car or write their books. Anyway, I have enjoyed this visit with you, Peter, and I hope you'll come back on a future show and share some more of your insights.
Well,
is there
anything
you'd like to say to people? Tell them how to find your podcast, perhaps?
Well, sure. You can find me at peterbcollins.com. You can also subscribe via iTunes if that's more convenient for you. And the main website is just plain peterbcollins.com. There's a contact form if you want to drop me a note or a suggestion or criticism. And I would just like to use this moment to support the people in Wisconsin who are challenging this autocratic Republican governor. And we're going to see more of this, where we really are at war with the, it's a class war, and they are winning. And every time you try to point out that it's a class war, they say, oh, you started it. And they point at working people and poor people and middle-class people. And we really have to rise to this occasion and not allow the budget problems that were created by Republicans in service to the wealthiest in this country to be used to club down the basic rights. And I'm not talking about the right to a flat-screen TV. I'm talking about the basic right to a good education, to good health care, and to earning a livable wage in a job that won't kill you. And we see right now on, it's not even on the horizon, it's right in our front yards, the interests of the Koch brothers and the ultra-wealthy in this country are being served by the huge wave of Republicans. And in addition to taking back control of the House of Representatives in Washington, the Republicans have a virtual lockdown control of state government in somewhere upwards of 20 of the states of the Union. Hmm. And so they are taking advantage of this to brutally roll back the gains that working families, unions, and the middle class fought for over a 50-year period. And if this isn't enough to get people out of their lounge chairs and into the streets and demanding their rights, then I don't know what will be. But I really hope that people will not take a pass and say, let somebody else do it. It's not my problem. I've still got a job. Because chances are, you're next.
Wow. It's thank you for that. I learned more about the situation in Wisconsin than I had known, and I'm going to be doing some Googling about it. And then maybe I can figure out some way to help. Thank you again, Peter.
All right. Great to talk to you.
I hope you'll come back and visit us again.
I sure will. Just invite me, and I wish you all the very best.
Well, it's been a long couple of weeks in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. It's getting warmer, which is not particularly good news for Charlie Johnson. He likes the cold and remembers when his son used to ask him what was the windshield temperature when they were both having their Quaker Oats at the table in the kitchen. Charlie likes those 20 below heroic temperatures. Zero is for wimps and above zero is for punks. At least that was his old tune. Maybe today he sings another song. Nobody has seen him much. He doesn't go down to coffee as much as he did when he was a sports reporter at the Wednesday Miracle. After he retired, he ran for city council and he got on. About the last thing he did was push hard for his Rock'em Sock'em Ronald Reagan ordinance, whereby the local council would act globally by sending a proposal to the White House and the United Nations that whenever world leaders wanted to go to war, they had to go fistfight the leader of the country they wanted the young people to invade first. Charlie thought it was a good idea. And he didn't think Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, the George Bushes, or Barack Obama would step into the ring with anyone, let alone another man. Now he writes letters to the editor, and they print some of them. He says what he thinks, which means he's pretty much as dead to the town, his hometown, the only town he has ever lived in, besides that one winter in Rapid City. He watched the Super Bowl by himself on that one Sunday evening 2 weeks ago. He had a plate of crackers and cut a guacamole thing, whatever, in half and just dipped out of both halves. And then a bottle of Guinness Stout with a frosted jelly glass that he had set in the fridge freezer the night before. He ended up only being able to drink about half the jelly glass. He forgot how strong that dark beer was. He put the pregame on mute and just watched between his fingers with his hands over his face as they flew the fighter planes over the stadium and spread out the giant flag and honored America by honoring killing and pretty much ruining it all before it started. Later, everyone complained about the girl who sang the national anthem, but nobody mentioned the killer planes. Well, anyway, Charlie's a Packers fan from way back, with Bart Starr and Jim Taylor, Ray Nitschke, Kramer, McGee, Forrest Gregg, Fuzzy Thurston. He knows that the Green Bay Packers were founded on August 11, 1919, by former high school football rivals Earl Curly Lambeau and George Whitney Calhoun. Lambeau solicited funds for uniforms from his employer, the Indian Packing Company. He was given $500 for uniforms and equipment on the condition that the team be named for its sponsor. Today, Green Bay Packers is the oldest team name still used in the NFL, both by its nickname and by virtue of remaining in its original city. Charlie fell asleep before the big black eyed peas halftime with his jelly glass in his lap, trying to remember the rest of the offensive line. The next morning, Charlie Johnson slumped in his chair, letting his right hand dingle with the clicker. He watched out the window, then looked back at the television at the silent laughter of his family on the playground. He'd seen this whole movie so many times, he just kept it on mute. He knew all the words. He just wanted to see the faces. On his legs, he balanced a yellow legal pad and pen. He took a break from writing for a while and again looked out the window, falling again for the trick his mind played on him that he would see anything new. Ronald Reagan grinned down from a photograph on the wall that June had brought home on the advent of Charlie's retirement from the newspaper. "They're coming to take me away, ha-ha." The line stuck in his head, though he hated it. He dreamed it last night and awoke with it ricocheting inside his skull like a motorized racquetball. Charlie mentally checked his things in the small bag by the door. Clean socks, underwear, t-shirts for sleeping, no holes, June would have insisted. Charlie's niece was coming over to pick him up. The family in the town had surmised from his letters to the editor that he needed a checkup at the Mount Liberty State Hospital. Charlie had agreed. He didn't want to be crazy any less than they wanted him to stop writing letters. A door slammed. Charlie looked to the TV screen and saw it was Fuzz, then to the street and saw a pickup pulled up in front. So this is how it's going to be. Charlie saw his niece striding up the walk. He went to meet her. She saw the bag. "You're all ready, yes?" "Jenny," proclaimed the white script stitching on her breast pocket. She grabbed the bag and pushed the door open for Charlie, waiting for him to check the burners, taps, doors, thermostat, the cat's food. He clicked the TV off, tossed the changer into his chair, let it lie when it bounced off the yellow pad to the floor. He pulled the front curtain closed. "Thanks," he said, walking past Jenny. He stopped in the doorway, turned around, and looked into what was his home. He sighed. His mouth quaked and his eyes became moist. Charlie turned and walked outside, stopping to straighten again the little green, white, and red flag. He marched down the steps with his head down, a fuchsia finally captured. "Observation, right?" Jenny asked as she followed Charlie down the walk. "That's what they say," Charlie said. As he sat, he hauled his leg inside with his hand and pulled the passenger door shut. "Just tests, I guess." As they took off, he remembered the letter he had just finished on the yellow pad. He looked at Jenny and decided against asking her to go back to get it and drop it off at the paper, maybe later. He read it once more in his head, checking for errors and insanity.
Dear editor, there's a church that I pass some oftentimes when I go for drives in the country, when the town gets to be too much. For some reason, I expect the country to be different. Fools me every time. There's this church, and a nice lawn, and a flag, and one of those glass-enclosed signs. You know, it tells when the services are, gives a little quip for the week. Some churches change them often. Some leave the same one up all winter. Maybe because it's too cold to stand out there and try to get those magnetic letters to stick. Maybe. Anyway, they could say so much with those things, but they don't. They stay uber-patriotic and American, which is to say, not very Christian, which is depressing, disheartening, defeating, disappointing. I wonder if the people who go to church here feel the same. I wonder if they drive to town just to see if there's anything different to be found anywhere.
That's the news from Mount Liberty, Nebraska, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the journalists are about average.
Well, it's time to wrap things up on the New American Dream Radio Show. I'd like to once again thank both Peter B. Collins and Ken Greenlee for appearing. Thanks to Peter B. Collins again and to the Rock Creek Free Press for sponsoring our show and for their contributions to the cause of free speech everywhere. And I give a special thanks to Mike Palachek for coming up with the idea of this show and for inviting me to help make it happen. Visit our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. That's I-N-F-O. Also our original site at newamericandream.net. If you need some web design or document management, editing, stop by my site, cwgservices.com. Maybe I can help out. We hope you'll listen again next week. Same time, same place. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Ken Lay. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left.
Which, by the way, that action you see Kennedy's head do in the Zapruder film? Caused by a bullet. Coming from up there. Yeah. I know it looks to the layman or someone who might dabble in physics. This action here would have been caused by a bullet coming from... Well... Up here! Did you see that? Did everyone see that? Yeah, but no. What happened was, Oswald's gun went off, causing an echo to echo through the buildings of Dealey Plaza. And the echo went by the limo on the left, up into the grassy knoll, hitting some leaves, causing dust to fly out, which 56 witnesses testified was a gunshot, because immediately Kennedy's head went over. But the reason his head went over is because the echo went by the motorcade on the left, and he went... What was that? So there. We have figured it out. Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it all transpired. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here is American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their fucking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
Oh, good. Honey, I heard on the news that they figured out that the gun, what happened is that there is an echo and that Kennedy was asking Jackie what it was, and that's why his head flew up. Honey, what time's Gladiators on? Are we missing it?
New from U.S. author Mike Palachek, Camp America. Here's what American poet David Ray has to say. Mike Palachek reminds me of Socrates, the gadfly who asked unwelcome questions, Diogenes with his lantern looking in vain for an honest man, Chekhov, the man with the hammer, challenging the complacent family to share their meal. Kerouac, the ever on the move, somewhat hysterical searcher. And he also reminds me of many Americans who as children were so blasted with propaganda that they're devoting the rest of their lives to challenging the lies and all who tell them. In this land where babies are brought by storks and buildings collapse due to unpatriotic bricks, we need the gadfly. Because no leader, preacher, guru, or saint will wake us up, though the doomsday clock is ticking close to 12. David Ray, American poet, author of The Endless Search and The Death of Sardanapalus and other poems of the Iraq Wars. To order Camp America and all of Mike Palachek's books, go to the New American Dream website, www.newamericandream.info. Howard Zinn writes, Mike Palachek writes with passion, wit, and always with a strong social conscience. Camp America, from author Mike Palachek. The website again, newamericandream.info.